I would just ask you all to volunteer to talk a little bit about why you're in this workshop. That helps me a lot so I can connect with you and understand what's motivating you. So would any of you who are here now be willing to raise your hand and say, you know, the reason I'm here? Okay, we got a great start there. Would you stand up? And and there's nothing, just shout it out.
Because I know you from ISI and Tim Hill.
Yes, I do recognize you. Remind me of your name again.
Phil Bonner.
Phil Bonner. Oh, wow, it's been so many years. I can't believe it. Thank you. It's wonderful to see an old friend. Wow. Okay, so there's one reason. Personal. Other reasons why you're in this workshop on the Woke Public University. Who else would like to talk about it? Yes.
My husband is a professor at a woke public university.
Really? Which one is he at? Would you mind saying? Or?
University of California.
Wow. One of the branches.
One of the branches.
Wow. And that is exceptionally woke because the University of California requires every faculty member, anybody who wants to be hired there, has to create a very elaborate DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, explanation for why they should be hired. And that's become true across not only social sciences and humanities there, but natural sciences and business, etc. So we're still working on the slides here. I'm going to keep talking, so thank you. I hope that what we share will help to provide some perspective for your husband. That's great. Who else had your hand up? I saw another hand up. Yes, John.
I'm a professor at a woke university.
Yes, a Midwestern one.
To redeem it. So I'm at the University of Nebraska.
Outstanding. Yes, 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 indeed. Thank you so much, John. Yes, over here.
And I'm another professor. I actually had to leave the States. I now teach in Ontario. At a very, very solid Christian school, but
really
had to leave. Even I've been tenured here at Northwestern and other schools that have gone this route.
Wow,
even Christian schools. So I'm glad to hear what you had to say.
Wow, were you at Northwestern in Iowa?
Twin Cities.
Oh, really? I live right by it.
Okay, right by there. Right on County Road D.
Oh, are you really? I'm just five houses east of the college on the other side of Snelling, directly.
So you're aware of the issues.
Yep. I am, and I'm going to cite that as an example without going into details of what's happening. Okay, we're still waiting. I assume that our technicians are going to still work, so we're going to keep talking. And if things don't to clear up quickly, then I'm going to try to give you something that you can visualize in your mind. But anyone else want to tell me why you're here? I'm so excited to have a number of professors and spouses. Yes. Right. And mental health issues, as you suggest, they're becoming gigantic in our universities. We know from very recent research that at least 60% of college-age women are dealing with significant levels of depression right now. It's really, really off the charts. So thank you for what you're doing. I saw a hand up way back there. Yes. That is okay. I'm so glad you're being us. Thank you.
I live 2 miles down the road, and I never have heard anything about Liberty at all. So I live about 2 miles from here, and I didn't know this existed.
Really?
So I guess I'm trying to get my feet under me and just figure out what is going on. And the word woke drives me crazy. What does it even mean?
Okay.
It's like everything that I've heard has been positive or negative, but everybody's so charged with what is it? Like,
what is woke? What a great way to start. Actually, thank you for acknowledging that you've just lived 2 miles away and you're trying to figure out what's going on at this Libri conference. So thank you for being here. I think this question, what does woke mean? Who would like to offer a definition? Would you like to be the one? Okay, would you stand up and give it and project your voice as well as you can?
I think I can do that.
You're doing good.
in my understanding of the idea of woke, which I first heard of while I was watching a YouTube video that's actually describing the famous instance of Jim Carrey showing up and being like, "You are not you. I'm not me." And everything else. Completely off the side because it's all poison and politics.
Sure.
But I think the idea of woke is supposed to indicate you are outside of the stream where everybody else is going. You are not a sheep. You are not following the path. You have woken up from whatever deep sleep we all are under. In other words, I know more than you do. I'm better.
I am better because I see reality more clearly.
I'm more conscious.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, it's not only arrogant and it's pride, but it's also flawed.
Yeah. Well, that's you're getting in the direction of what we mean by woke. There's more to it than that, but it's that sense of awakening from some sort of what Marx would have called a kind of false consciousness. So essentially, though, what happens for our questioner in the back with this great question to start off with, what essentially happens is people, when they become aware of the fact that the world is made up of oppressors and the oppressed, and that's the only really fundamental social division that matters. When you become aware of that, then that idea fills your consciousness and you begin to recognize which one of those you are, an oppressor or an oppressed person, then you are truly woke. And that becomes the mental framework, the paradigm through which you see all the rest of life. Does that help? And getting that idea. So that's what we're talking about. Yes, yes. Thank you for reminding me to do that. Thank you. So let me repeat that again. So essentially, when you become woke, your awareness of reality, of social reality, it becomes sharpened. And you realize that all along, reality has been made up of only two groups of people, either the oppressed or the oppressor, and that all of social reality can be broken down to and reduced to that question. And that question determines all kinds of social relations. And ultimately, it's pointing to the idea that we need to bring down the oppressors and elevate the oppressed. Okay? So that's the idea of being woke. That's what people mean by it. Now, let me say this very clearly. The concept of woke, the language of woke, let me talk about the language of woke. That's really being used primarily by conservatives like myself to some degree as a pejorative. The language was introduced by people with Black Lives Matter in the mid-2015, give or take. It was introduced by that group, but most progressives, people who are what we would call, at least people like me, not everyone in this room, I'm sure, but people like me would call woke, they would describe themselves as progressives. So that's the language that they would use. Okay. I hope that helps. Now, let me ask you another question. Why do you think I have the line through naked? What am I doing there? Yes.
Because what was once a Christian society later became desacralized, and now people are trying to get it down.
Okay, so you're on the right track exactly, and that's actually, you're setting up beautifully. So what he said, for those of you who couldn't hear, is that essentially we had a once Christian-centric society that then, in light of scientific thought in the 20th century, stripped out Christianity and resulted in a naked public square and a naked university. I'll elaborate in just a minute about that. But now what's happening with woke public education is people are seeking to regain some kind of morality that was lost in the naked public university. So you set me up very well. So let's get into this. And what we're going to be doing today in the remaining time that we have, and I want to invite you to raise your questions as I move along, because I realize that as I speak, you'll get more sleepy. I know how I get. So feel free to raise your questions during my lecture. I'll make sure we get to the destination by 11:45, I promise. Okay, so we're going to look at three models of higher education. We've already alluded to that. We'll talk about how that connects with worldviews, because that's a very central concept here at the Libri Conference for our friend who just has entered this conference in the last several hours. We'll talk about the characteristics of woke public higher education, its successes, its problems. Then we'll look at a very, very new and recent case study that some of you are probably aware of, Hamline University, which is a private university with a historic church background, but very secular now, just 5 miles from where I live, actually. And then I think this is the most important thing you want to hear, is you want to look at the six scenarios that I envision for the future of the woke public university. This is very, very important. I think the most important part of what I'm going to be saying, although I would love to have you think with me, if we have time at the end, about a Christian framework for evaluating Christian higher education, and that's a framework that I've developed. I'll say more about that later. So the way to frame this up is to look at the work of Christian historian George Marsden. He, in 1994, Oxford University Press published what is now a classic in the history of higher education in America, The Soul of the American University. And what he basically said in that was that in the 17th through 19th centuries, beginning with the founding of Harvard University in 1636, all the way through almost the end of the 19th century, the public university, as well as the private universities in America, were essentially Christian to one degree or another. And so we had a kind of Christian hegemony. Now, the word hegemony means control or the ability to direct the pathway of an institution. So we had Protestant Christian hegemony. You found that what would go on in those schools, they would study classic texts that were Latin, Greek, and then, of course, they look at biblical text. That was pretty much what they would focus on, because initially they were wanting to prepare pastors. Now, as the public universities emerged, as I'm going to talk about in a minute, that quickly changes. But in the very initial founding, this is what happened. And there was a strong focus on Christian morality in those universities. But you'll see the red button that I have, and that's meant to convey the idea of an alarm. Something began to happen in the middle of the 19th century. And that was that at that time, a few very bright Americans began to go to Germany to study in the German research universities. Again, Marsden covers this very, very well in his classic text. And as they went there, they went to a society that had already rejected the idea that Christianity had anything to offer in the area of public knowledge. And I'll say more about this when I look at Schaeffer's two-story model of knowledge. But they went there, and when they came back, they brought back something very different than the idea of the Christian public university. And then, in terms of policy, the Morrill Land Grant, which resulted in the founding of places like University of Nebraska, University of Minnesota, all of these institutions, Michigan State University, where they had that horrific shooting the other day. These are all what we know as land grant universities. And the government said, we're going to grant to states large plots of land so that they can form universities where the education will begin to focus on agriculture and engineering. So you see now there begins to be a switch, a change in the direction of the curriculum. But at the same time, thanks to things that developed in the late 18th century with Kant and other philosophers, most with German names, quite frankly, the two-story theory of knowledge developed, and that brings us to Francis Schaeffer. So those of you who've been around Francis Schaeffer, who was the founder of LaBrie, and that's why, as you heard earlier, that we have this conference here, Dr. Schaeffer, in his work with students who had come to Switzerland beginning in the 1950s, he found that what you could say about their Western-based education was that they saw reality, at least in terms of knowledge, existing in two categories. Up here was the lofty sort of religious ideas and the kind of grand ideas that we had about how life works, and ideas of morality were all up here. But Kant and other philosophers said, we don't really know that those ideas of reality are really true. They're quite subjective. But what Kant and those philosophers said, and Schaeffer made this very clear in his writings, was that down at this level, the lower level, we have scientific knowledge. We have factual knowledge. That's the kind of thing that we study when we do engineering. When we study agriculture, economics, which my friend John Anderson teaches in Nebraska, that's the kind of thing that's down there. That's the kind of knowledge we can be sure of. Now, in his own way, Kant was actually trying to protect Christian knowledge from the rise of science. But in fact, what he did was to diminish this upper story. So the only thing we do public policy on is the lower story, right? So now we get into the naked public university. So the way to frame that is to look at the work of Richard John Neuhouse, who wrote The Naked Public Square in 1984. And he said that what America is like in this 20th century is a society where we only use that lower story knowledge to design what we are, to adopt the policies that we do. We will not discuss morality here. We don't really want religion here. We'll tolerate private religious entities like Campus Crusade and university campus ministries, et cetera, but not relevant to what we're doing. So when you think about the naked public university, you're thinking about an institution where a secular kind of hegemony, that is a set of ideas that explicitly is devoid of any kind of religious, overtly religious content, at least content that includes the idea of divinity, that replaces the Protestant hegemony. And Marsden, who I talked about earlier, he explains the process very well. He said one hegemony replaces the other one. And hegemonies are the desire, again, to control, to determine the future. And when you have the desire, as I will show later, to be in control, you don't want anybody fighting you. You don't want anybody disagreeing with you. Okay? Now, let me say this with the group that's here today. And whenever I speak, at least, I'm always telling people, listen, I welcome your pushback. Now, I'm not trying to set myself up as some sort of paragon of anti-hegemonic thought. But I hope that if you are thinking, I don't like where he's going, I think he's missing something, I hope you'll push back and I'll welcome it. At least, I think I will. You'll find out. So, in terms of the epistemology, theory of knowledge, that's what we're talking about when we talk about epistemology. Again, we have the two-story theory that I've just introduced you to. Number two is the idea that reason and research are really replacing revelation. And that's pretty obvious, I think, for anybody who was raised and educated as I was in the 20th century. But you also have to admit now, and we now admit it more frequently than we ever did before, that the objective pursuit of truth, which we thought we were doing in much of the 20th century in the naked public university because we had science, we had facts, That's a bit of an illusion, because we tend to filter everything that we see and know through a set of mental paradigms called worldviews, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. So, number four, this is where the alarm bell starts to go off. So I noted with the Protestant Christian University, something began to change. And something began to change in the 20th century with the naked public university. It started out looking really hopeful. But then we began to realize, and I think, you know, these are broken thoughts that people have. They're fragments of ideas. But eventually, larger thinkers put these together. We realized, and especially from a Christian perspective, that we had a kind of deformed love. We were focused only on the material world, and that was the only world we could talk about. And then we came to realize, and again, I'm offering this perspective as a Christian, that our thinking became more disordered, because when you think that you have pure rationality and that there is no basis for revelation, and if you think that based on research that this thing up here inside my and your brain cavity is nothing but a brain, there is no mind there. It's just a brain. It's got neurons firing. It's got blood flowing through it. It's cells. It's those kinds of things. Then you begin to think to yourself, well, maybe, is it possible that those things that are firing in my brain are leading me to see reality incorrectly? Because what is it that would make neurons firing and blood flowing, and that's all we can allow for in a purely secular understanding, a purely naturalistic understanding? How do we know that that leads to truth? And you can read the work of Alvin Plantinga, who's done a wonderful job of just tearing into this and saying, here is what we're faced with. And no one has been able to refute Plantinga's work in this. Alvin Plantinga. And then, last of all, what we began to realize, at least in the last half of the 20th century, throughout my lifetime, was that we had the ability to destroy ourselves. And we still have that ability. And with the greater sense of the threat of world war looming over us than any time since the 60s, I would say, this seems quite existential at this moment. So morality was thrown out. You couldn't talk about morality in the naked public university. You could only talk about research and reason. And this results in a social vacuum, a so-called neutral vacuum, but it ultimately leaves people wanting much, much more. They want meaning. What is it about us as human beings? Well, are you able to live your lives with whomever you live them? Are you able to live them with just very scientific, factual talk? I've been married 47 years. I can assure you that at least my wife is really quite unhappy with that kind of conversation. And if she was feeding me that kind of stuff too, I would eventually, somewhat later than her, but I would get weary of it. And if it was a conversation that never told me how to treat her or how to behave toward her, or her toward me, with no moral reference points, I would be yearning for something more. And this is where we left students in the 20th century. For many of us who are older, this is the education we got. And so, by the way, this Christian Smith's Secular Revolution and Julie Rubin's book expands on this so much. I'm sorry, I just got to keep moving here. But here we are in the 21st century. And so in some sense, you will hear me speaking with a certain kind of sympathy for the students of today, because they're wired as moral beings, not just thinking machines. And you and I are too. And so now we have a kind of postmodern hegemony where knowledge is sought for the purpose of social activism. That is what the woke public university, its purpose statement is: social activism, transforming society.
What end?
It's to the end of erasing all distinctions between oppressors and oppressed. That's the end to which today's woke public university is aiming. Yes, Phil.
Why don't you just call them Marxists?
Well, the reason I won't call the woke public university Marxist is because it's not truly Marxist in the classic sense. I've even read very conservative authors who will tell you they push back strongly on that idea. So that's basically what. Yes.
Right. Anytime, like you're saying, nature abhors a vacuum. Anytime you get rid of something, if your goal is activism, unless your entire goal is complete social anarchy, and that's just your plan,
right?
Then what do they plan to replace it with? Because that's what actually scares me a little.
You mean replace, make different about our society? You're asking what?
You get rid of oppressors and oppressed.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. That's a really interesting question, and I've not thought a lot about it, but let me just try, and I'll welcome anybody else to maybe contribute. So what replaces, if the woke students today, in our, I'm calling woke public universities, and you'll see if you look at the very bottom, I only think 6 to 10% of the faculty are probably genuinely woke. It's not a majority of faculty, by the way. It's really not. But if those woke students with this commitment to social activism can erase all distinctions between the oppressed and the oppressor and bring in genuine equality, or they use the word equity, what would happen? I think in their idea, they see themselves pointing towards the utopia that they as human beings long for. Now, if some of you know Udo Mittelmann, who is Schaefer's son-in-law. I think some of you are aware of that. He's here at the conference. Years ago, Udo taught me, and he's right, he's so right about this, that we must at all cost resist utopian thinking. But it's in our brains. It's inside our minds. So it's both the material and the immaterial aspect I'm referring to. It's in there. And why do we have the desire for utopia? Because we were created in the image of a God who wants for us the best, who wants us to flourish. Sin has demolished that whole possibility, but we who are following Jesus Christ, we know what it is to have a renewed sense of hope, a renewed sense of rationality. Our morality begins to be more ordered instead of disordered. But we know that the utopia that all of us long for will never come until Jesus returns the second time. And the Bible is very clear about his return. But what these students want to be able to do is they want to be able to bring that grand utopia. They want to speed it up. They want to bring it this side of Christ's return. But every utopian experiment ends up with a massive amount of bloodshed. There's one that that caused the deaths of 100 million people around the world in the 20th century. What utopian experiment led to that?
Communism.
Exactly, communism and Marxism. Exactly. Your comment was they didn't do Marxism right. Yeah, that's the classic line, isn't it? And we have to be careful when we, as Christians, say, well, if only they would do Christianity right, then everything would become wonderful and perfect. You see, we have to resist the utopian ideal even within the Christian community.
Who's going to be in charge of these utopias?
Your question was, who is in charge of the utopianists? some very bad people, I promise you. Those are the worst, most scary movies you've ever seen. Those kind of people would be in charge. So, but I hope you realize that today's students, they're finding something here that they've longed for, and we did not provide in the naked public university. And they're now finding something. They're finding meaning and morality in the woke public university. And some of the characteristics of that include this strong, profound, almost profound emphasis on radical human autonomy. By the way, when you read Schaefer, who was writing back in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, he talks about radical human autonomy all the time, and he's exactly where we are today. But they combine that with a radical exaltation of subjective consciousness, so that what's happening inside my brain, inside my mind, is what really everybody else has to accept. And so, to tie in with what Vishal was talking about earlier, if I say that I'm a woman, because of the exaltation of subjective consciousness, you have to accept that. You have no choice. I have every legal right to demand that you do that. At least I have a moral right, I would say. I don't know if it's a legal right at this point. Many of them would like to make it a legal right. But if I think I'm, you know, a flower, then you must accept that. So there's some, in the quest for meaning and morality, there's huge sacrifices that are being made in terms of knowledge, and this will lead no place good. Now, I point out under 2.3, it should be 2C, but I didn't remember to change that lettering. 3C. Christian inspired deference and a sensitivity leads to moralism, cancel culture, and deplatforming. Now, here's what I'm trying to say, is that today's woke activists and students and professors, to one degree or another, they are actually importing Christian ethics to give valor and a very warm patina to what they're teaching and doing. So you wouldn't find this concern for the oppressed outside of a Christian moral framework. Christianity had to provide the initial impetus for this. Now, it's true that Buddha was very concerned for the suffering of the people that he found outside of his place where he lived for most of his life. And he was deeply wounded by that, and he wanted to figure out why people suffered. And he said it's because of this tremendous level of desire inside of human beings. But he never really created any sort of method or process for resolving this kind of reality. Now, under 4B, I just want to emphasize again, I would say no more than 6 to 10% of faculty in our universities are woke. They're almost all of them are in humanities and social sciences. But that number is going up fast. It's going up very fast because these people, when they get control of And they do inevitably get control of faculty hiring committees. They hire only woke people. You have to use exactly the, and they know exactly the language to look for. If you go to my next lecture tomorrow morning on worldview consciousness, I'll talk about a lot of the language that's used, and you'll recognize this vocabulary that comes right out of the woke vocabulary. So let's summarize. Let's look at this from the perspective of worldviews and academia. Number one, we go back to the Christian worldview. We understand that God is in all of knowledge. In Him we live and move and have our being, says the Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 17, verse 28, to all the philosophers in Athens. And certainly we understood in that way of understanding that knowledge comes primarily through revelation, but we welcome and we embrace reason and research enthusiastically. And I will suggest to you that, in fact, I predict that in the coming years, Christians will be some of the primary defenders of science in the best way of understanding science. But what happened in this understanding, the Christian perspective or Christian worldview, morality was a very significant consideration. But again, to recapitulate what I've been saying, when you come to the 20th century with its exaltation of the scientific naturalist worldview and its two-story theory of knowledge, you push morality to the side. What the postmodern worldview now in the woke public university and our private universities as well wants to do is to transcend rationality. We push rationality aside. We exalt subjective consciousness, but we give a place for morality. So I hope this recapitulation in light of worldviews helps you to understand how this works. Now, let me say some things about postmodernism. I want to drill down because this is the filter through which people who are highly woke see all of reality. Once again, and I'm going to expand on some of what I've said, not only do they see all of life socially broken down between oppressors and the oppressed, but what helps them to get to this point philosophically is to be suspicious about all grand stories or meta-narratives or worldviews. When I use the term grand stories, worldviews, meta-narratives, I really mean the same thing. Now, what this means in practice is that the postmodernist says that every text, whether it's verbally spoken or it's one written or it's a film that you're watching or music that you're listening to, every text is seeking to build and reinforce your hegemony or your desire for it. So right now, at this moment, if you're a true postmodernist, you suspect me highly as an oppressor who is trying to bring you under my thumb so that I can oppress you. Thus, it means also that when a Christian goes out to evangelize and share Christ with people, in fact, what is happening at that time is you are trying to bring them under your thumb. You're trying to get power over them. And it's just your way of doing it. So you have to understand that there's immense suspicion that's built into the postmodern meta-narrative. Now remember something, that it isn't always bad to suspect things. I try to interrogate my own motives. Interrogate means to question my own motives quite regularly because, you know, Christ has worked in my life over the last 53 years since I found him at the University of Michigan in 1969. And so it looks like we got another Michigan. Oh, wonderful. I'm glad to feel that I'm not the only one in the room. I say, Bob, what's going on in you? What do you want? What's happening? Check your motives. And to be honest with you, it has helped me to suspect myself. I don't do it in a pathological way. At least I don't think I'm pathological. And if I am, nobody's going to tell me. They're just going to put me in a funny house. But you know, we do have to suspect. I think we have to start with suspecting ourselves. You know, I what are my motives? Where am I coming from? Yes, question.
Yeah, you know, you use that word power.
Yeah.
And I heard a speaker suggest recently that that is actually the belief of postmodernism. There's a suspicion towards all meta-narratives except for power.
Right? Correct. Yes.
And power is
good.
Power is the fundamental belief, and that's why when it comes into action, right? It leads towards taking charge of committees, boards.
Exactly.
And because if you believe in power, then there's only one way.
So, for the sake of those who are listening on the audio tape or something, on the audio file, what this gentleman said very correctly is that the issue of power is central to the postmodernist. And that's the one thing they will not interrogate. Now, why is that? There's actually a reason why that can't be done, they would say. Nietzsche was the one in the 19th century who really, as the father of nihilism, really explained this. He said that, first of all, he wanted to essentially show that if you throw God out of the equation, if God is dead, there's no possibility of human consciousness, thus no thoughts, thus no ideas, thus no rationality, no meaning, no morality. It's all gone. It's emptiness. But he said there's something that is still left. And what do we see in nature? And he said if we're just simply molecules, blood, neurons firing, blah, blah, blah. What you do see in nature is you see force, you see energy, you see stones and rocks falling on each other. So there is power, but power is not something that can ever be discussed or dealt with in rational ways. The only thing you do with power is you get a bigger gun and you blast that threat to your power. And I often use the illustration when I talk about this. When I was growing up, and most men here will recognize this, King of the Hill. And so on our little rural school back in the 1950s and 60s, you know, some guy would insist on finding a pile of gravel that was left there by whatever constructor, and he'd climb up on top and say, "I'm King of the Hill." And, you know, the rest of us, initially, we might try to reason with him. Since I was the book-minded intellectual type, I was trying to reason, but that didn't work very well. It never does with these kind of guys. And so sooner or later, the only way you could deal with a guy like this was raw power. And so everybody would rush him, bring him down, and show him that he's not King of the Hill. But this intense focus on power, as you said, is very central to the postmodernists. As I suggest in number 3, you combine the will to power with disordered thinking, where subjective consciousness supersedes science, and then you have a deformed love, where the only thing you want to focus on is oppressed humanity. That's the only thing that you can see out there. And you combine that, you end up with what we have as the woke university. Now, partly this gets to your point, and I'll take your question in just a minute in the back. But will postmodernism permit its eclipse? I'm very convinced that it will not. I'm not alone. I'll introduce you later. I think it's in this lecture. Yeah, it's in this lecture. I'll introduce you to Joshua Mitchell, professor of political science, another Michigan graduate. Go blue. A professor of political theory and science at Georgetown University. A fascinating book that I'll introduce you to in a minute. He's convinced, absolutely, we're going to have bloodshed, one way or the other, because the postmodern frame does not allow its eclipse. It must maintain its power. Now, let's take your question in the back, okay?
Came up because of the lack of Christian morals within education. So
Yes. The woke is really a response to the naked public university, which had already thrown Christianity out, and we were left only with pure, raw knowledge and no focus on our moral responsibilities to our neighbors. That's okay. You take your time.
But at the heart of the movement, I'm hearing that it's understanding the dynamics and entering the world of the oppressed, correct?
Could you repeat that last? I didn't quite hear your last word.
Part of the idea of being woke is that there is the oppressed and there is the oppressor.
Correct. Yeah.
And because of the lack of Christian morals is how that kind of arose. Yet, I'm confused because this idea of understanding our role and our power over others and giving up that power just like Jesus gave up his power when he came here, I'm not hearing a lot of what is going on within the woke culture that goes contrary to Christian belief.
Okay.
So understand, pronouns and gender.
That's okay, yeah.
But this idea of understanding that I have power because I'm already, and I have that through oppressing others. Jesus spent a lot of majority of his time on earth reaching out to the oppressed.
Right.
So I guess I'm just confused as to why this is so far.
See why I'm painting this so negatively. The question you're asking is, why am I painting this so negatively? Because when we read the Gospels, it looks like Jesus was really advocating for the oppressed. And to reinforce your point, if you look at his announcement of his ministry around age 29 in Capernaum, he says, I'm here to set the prisoners free. I'm to give people hope. These are some real significant themes that come out there, and we see it in the way he lived it out. So the way I would like to respond to your very good question is that what we have essentially in woke culture, in many respects, is the assertion of a Christian moral understanding of our responsibilities to our neighbors. A Christian is not to ignore their neighbor and let them wallow in suffering, in poverty, ignorance. And that's something that's embedded from Jesus on down into the Christian worldview. Those, that moral framework has been, so to speak, drawn into the postmodern framework. And the postmodern framework says, hey, it's a good thing that you try to set the oppressed free, but you have to remember that there's only two kinds of people here. Those with power, the oppressors, and those without power. Now, what Christianity wants to say, by contrast to this, is that the division in Christianity, the division in the world is not between the oppressor and the oppressed. It's between the, what I would call the saved sinner and those unsaved. And so all of us have within our hearts this propensity to disobey the God of the universe, to do what we shouldn't do and to fail to do what we should do. This is Romans chapter 7. And when we understand that way of understanding reality, then we realize that the only kind of power that should be sought is essentially aspiring for the Lord's power or seeking his glory and not attempting to make ourselves one of those who is no longer an oppressor. Because in the process, we're going to end up, I think, becoming a different kind of oppressor. So let me thank you for that question, and I'll be glad to follow up more. But I have two questions here. Let's take your question.
Why, if you were a secular postmodernist, not a Christian, why wouldn't you exalt power? Why wouldn't you want the strongest to win and lord it over everybody else?
Right. Well, this is what the question you're asking is, if you were a postmodernist, why wouldn't you want those with power to win? So this is part of the contradiction that comes in here. The postmodernist is fundamentally a materialist at an ontological level. At the fundamental level of reality, they believe that matter is all there is. I mean, most postmodernists do, not all, but most do. And so the only thing that can be there, says Nietzsche, is power. So you're quite right. And so there is a real contradiction in the woke movement between their importation of Christian ethics and concern for the poor and the oppressed and the insistence that everything is matter and thus the only thing we can get and should pursue is power. So you raise a very good point there, I think. Yes, sir.
Is it more specifically the power, so power is the ethic, but is it specific for this movement to the power for the marginalized? So whatever group has been marginalized in whatever respect I'm marginalized,
right,
I lack some successful attribute, right?
Right.
Or some luck, right? I don't have it. Then it's power for those people, right? And so there's this image by the Bible Project. Have you ever seen the Bible Project videos on YouTube? Okay, They've got an image of this that might get at this. You have someone who's an oppressor, right?
Yeah.
They're high up. They've got a staff pushing down the block of the person who's the oppressed, right? Mm. And the oppressed in history often takes the staff, pulls it out, and becomes the oppressor, right? And the alternative that they advocate for the Bible is that the oppressor reaches the hand down and pulls the other person up, right?
Yeah.
But there's a potential here that this movement does not have that helping hand vision, right? It's power for the marginalized. And that. So the question I would have is, you're being very sympathetic, I think, trying to be towards the woke movement.
Yeah.
And that's because many people adopt these beliefs from all different backgrounds, I think, and I think
you
know that. And many people mean well.
Yeah, sure.
But how would you distinguish between morality as motivation and revenge?
Yeah.
Because revenge is also a powerful motivator and resentment.
Wow. Yeah, that's a very good question. In making this analysis, how would I distinguish between revenge and the other one was?
Resentment. And I'm not getting, I got that from listening to other speakers.
That sounds like Nietzsche, by the way, to bring up this. He had the idea of ressentiment, but it's basically that. I'd have to really think about that, and that's a very good question. You really got me wondering about that.
You're giving the benefit of the doubt to people, and I think it's right to try to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think we have to be very cautious. If power is the ethic, right?
And it is.
We must be aware, because there are sometimes people who don't mean well.
Precisely. And that's why, to get back to our questioner at the back, I want to just reinforce the idea that at the end of the day, when you're combining some of this Christian-inspired sympathy with the postmodern focus on power and power, 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 at the end of the day, for most people, because we are sinners at heart, even Christian born-again Christians are, because we are sinners at heart, you're going to end up with power. You will default to power. You will not retain the sympathetic side. So I think your warning is right on target, that we must recognize the tremendous risk involved here. And while I am trying to be sympathetic to understand why people get into this, I see it as a major problem because, as you can see here, ultimately, the public universities with the woke public university are going to, and are now, violating basic standards of rationality and the expectations of citizens. This will and is creating, it is now creating disunity. I've already said and implied to a great extent that at heart we are natural hegemonists. That gets back to that point again, the tension between the Christian inspiration and the postmodern intense focus on power. We're going to go for hegemony. And I would say that, dare say that the vast majority of us in this room, if given the opportunity to force our will on others, would probably be find that very appealing, at least. And some of us would actually go there. We're talking about something that is literally, in the woke public university, an intolerant religion that is having dramatic influence on Christian institutions. And you, my professor friend from Ontario, have already alluded to that in a well-known, very conservative Christian university just a block or two from where I live in Roseville. And it's infected that university. Virtually every Christian university, to some degree or another, is infected with it. It's just a matter of degree. It's roaming wild through our evangelical churches, I'm sorry to say. And some of you may be products of this, but I want to help you to see how religious this whole movement is. Again, where we're going now is to a new kind of very vicious religion. You've got the atheist John McWhorter says that woke racism is a new religion that has betrayed black America. Joshua Mitchell, the Michigan graduate that I was talking about earlier, American Awakening is an outstanding book of political theory. I highly recommend it, and I think you should read it. Noah Rothman is a much more eclectic, sort of roaming book, but a very new one, The Rise of the New Puritans. And that's the language that also Andrew Doyle is using in another book, The New Puritans, both looking at postmodernism and woke, what we call wokeism in society today. So those are some titles you might want to pursue if you want to dig into this. But again, now a little more sympathetic. Why does this succeed in higher education? Student energies toward activism. It presumes bias and discrimination, so it plays to student sympathies. The rise of victimism or victim power. I can tell you that today, in our universities, you want to be seen as a victim. That is a superior position, morally. That gives you moral standing in a way that no one else has. And so someone like me, a white Christian male, come on. You know, I am literally, and sometimes I work with a lot of foreign students, I tell them, you've got to understand that from the standpoint of the wokists who are gaining greater power in our universities and institutions, I am the living portrait of the enemy. I am the oppressor. And so when you're talking with me, you have to understand that a lot of the Americans you're seeing and Westerners you're seeing on the sidewalks here at the university are wondering why you're spending time with somebody who is the chief oppressor. But that's where we're at today. But as I've already implied, human beings need a grand story. We need this. And so woke public universities are giving students the meaning that they did not have during the era of the naked public university. And so now we have 80% of our students on our campuses who report self-censoring. But what are some arguments against the woke public university? Because I've got to get to the scenarios. That's extremely important we talk about this. Its focus on power and race, gender, and class. It undermines traditional understandings of rationality and truth. It's conceptually flawed from a Christian perspective. And I would like to focus on the third bullet point, the sub-bullet point. And I got this from Christopher Watkins in his new book, Biblical Critical Theory. Don't like the title, but it's really a great book, and I recommend it. He is the one who helped me understand that it's a deep mistake to read history through the lens of the Exodus. So The idea is that we are going out there to release the enslaved, the oppressed. It's the Exodus narrative matches that perfectly. But his point is that history is primarily about creation, fall, redemption, and consummation when Christ returns. That's the major Christian meta-narrative. To focus on the Exodus alone is a completely sub-biblical way of understanding reality. And the last thing I want to say, and I'm going through this extremely quickly, is that the postmodernism that's conveyed through woke public universities is a new kind of ideological colonialism that's being spread around the world, primarily through foreign students, but also through Americans who are going with the Peace Corps and so forth. All of them today are carrying a degree of wokeism. And this is in fact the most dangerous kind of colonialism you could imagine. Now, what happened at Hamline University? So I'm going to summarize this very briefly. At Hamline University, you had a professor of art history this last fall who showed an image of Muhammad. Some Muslims say that showing an image of Muhammad is an incredible blasphemy against Islam. This female professor warned students at the beginning of the semester. She warned them extensively in class that she would be showing this image. If you don't like it, no problem. You won't be degraded. You can just leave the class because I'm not trying to offend you. But sure enough, one of them insisted on staying in the class, the president of the Muslim Student Association. That student then went and complained to the university administration. They immediately took the side of the student against the faculty member and initially accused the faculty member of Islamophobia and other scurrilous claims. Now, it's interesting that this is one of the very few cases in recent years where it looks like most faculty members are siding with the faculty member in this case. Because in most of the recent cancellations or deplatformings or firings from university faculties, most faculty have piled on the offender and said, you deserve to be thrown out of here, you're an oppressor, etc., etc. But faculty right now are generally coming to the side of this, and I think rightly so. I agree fully with the defense of this professor who showed this image. But what I found in a conversation, and it was a moderated conversation with some faculty members at the University of Minnesota 2 weeks ago on looking at religion in the public university, we discussed this at great length. I was the only one of the 10 or so faculty types there, I used to teach at the University of Minnesota, who was concerned about the task of instruction. All of them were concerned to wrestle with how does a student feel. Now, they were trying to say that we still have to do what we're supposed to do, but we need to be thinking about how students feel. And I, you know, some of that I appreciate. I mean, I don't want to walk into a class and just, you know, spout off stuff and just not care at all how students are responding emotionally. But I don't think that's the major issue. The major issue is, what is our job as an instructor? It's to teach and convey knowledge and help people understand what to do with that knowledge in this fallen world. So, we could say so much more about that. Now I want to get into the scenarios. I don't think I can take any more questions right now because I really want to dig into these scenarios. And you'll see them listed here. I'm going to go right into them. So the first scenario that I see for where this is going in our universities is wokeness will dig in. This I think is a recent image from the Ukrainian war. And so the idea of digging is you build a trench, and then you've got your guns out there and you're protecting yourself as they try to fire on you. You dig in. I think that's the most likely scenario right now. And that's what Joshua Mitchell says in American Awakening. Now, let's talk about faculty and understand how this connects with the dig-in phenomenon. Most faculty are actually temperamentally conservative, even though Many of us think that, you know, faculty are left-wing liberals. Well, that may be true to some extent, but temperamentally, and I'm looking at a number of faculty here, I know you guys, you're temperamentally conservative. You don't like change. You go to a faculty meeting and faculty members, any change is bad. It doesn't matter what it is, it's bad. So most faculty are not comfortable with change, but the other part of them is most of them tend to be, or most of us, I'm including myself in that sense, we tend to be kind of easy to steamroll because you don't want to put up a fight. You don't want to be seen as the lone voice who's opposing the woke steamroller, so you close your mouth. And I know Christian faculty right now who are doing that in public universities. And then the pressures for ideological conformity are great. You want to be one of the team. You don't want to be, you know, an outlier, as we call them. Now, on top of that, another reason wokeness digs in is because we have an ever-increasing percentage of the employees in our universities are administrators. And those people, they don't have to go through tenure review. And many of them are highly woke. In fact, they're almost being hired for their wokeness. Right now, in a major, major, huge public research university that I know very well, I in the last 2 weeks, I've had a conversation with a significant and important administrator who says, "I am spiritually and mentally exhausted." That's a quote. The other one was a very highly placed administrator and faculty member, had both roles. And he said to me several weeks ago, he said, "I am tired of being unhappy all the time." This is taking a tremendous toll on many people in the institutions. I think it's fueling the tremendously mental problems that some of you are having to deal with. Another scenario is that defund and regulate. This is the Ron DeSantis strategy. It's a very pragmatic outside-in strategy. Hey, we're gonna stop funding public universities, as Richard Hanania and others are recommending. We're going to restrict what they can teach. That's the DeSantis approach. I think it's got some problems theoretically, but that's the idea there. You will shut down the DEI, that's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion offices, that on average in Big Ten universities have at least 45 staff members, minimum. Well, no, that's, I'm sorry, I contradicted myself. The average is 45. Some minimums are lower, some are much higher. That's one, I don't think it's a very likely scenario to work in most places, but it may work in certain states, like Florida. Now, Ben Sasse, who was a U.S. senator and whom many of us respect and appreciate, has just taken the job as the president of the University of Florida. Will he institute a third scenario, which is reform from within? Now, this is based on the recent work of Frederick Hess, who's a major education policy researcher that is worth reading. I like to read anything he writes. I don't always agree with him. But I don't want to go through the list here, but you have them on your handouts. There are 8 basic things that he thinks should be done to reform the university from within, to stop the woke public university, to shut it down. And you know, he uses language like, number 5, bust the cartel. So in a sense, this is kind of one hegemony pushing back on the other. But hey, to some degree, it's in the pursuit of justice. But how much? I don't know. A fourth possible scenario is what I call defenestration, which means the universities lose their powers of credentialing. Now, why is this important? Why did most of us go to the university besides the fact that our parents wanted us to go there? And besides the fact that several of us actually love to learn? Well, I think the answer for many people would be to get a good job. And I understand that. I thoroughly understand that. The universities up to this point, in order to get a good job, the universities have said, you've got to take our credential, the bachelor's, master's, doctorate, whatever it is, and that's the only way you're going to get a good job. But now, very recently, especially during our era of low employment, in which we have millions of jobs that are not being filled, some businesses we now know, and it's just coming out in the last month, are no longer requiring a four-year degree. That is terrifying, university presidents. Believe me. That is terrifying them. Because if that thing metastasizes in different industries, the universities are cooked, at least as we know them today. And actually, this is a scenario that I think is fairly likely. I think this is much more likely than a lot of, other than digging in, which is, I think, very likely. Losing credentialing powers will be disastrous. Parents and students will say, why? Why spend all that money? Why borrow? Even if Biden is going to pay back all of our loans, why borrow the money? Why get in trouble? Why not go to work as an apprentice for a technician who will teach you how to do and will also use YouTube videos as well as all kinds of other much more advanced online tools to give you the theory behind how you are to do something. Very significant, I think. Another thing that's happening right now, as some of you know, I was part of this movement. I love it tremendously, the widespread emergence of Christian study centers. This is a big deal. We have people here from the Anselm House. You can see them at their table out there with Dan Olson and Becca Jones and A.J. Polarenz. They're all part of Anselm House. They're doing fantastic work where Christians are staking a claim, not just for campus ministry, but for actually Christian, thoughtful Christian presence inside our universities. This is a growing movement, and I love what they're doing with the Consortium of Christian Study Centers, which you, my friend from Canada, will be amazed to discover that the consortium was founded on the campus of University of Northwestern in 2008. I was there when it happened. This is the one that I'm pushing, but I don't... I've learned, I'm 72, I'm old enough to have a little, I'm optimist, I am a visionary, but I'm also trying to be a bit of a realist. The pluralistic public university, I think, is the only legitimately just way for public higher education to proceed in America. I truly believe it. This would mean that you would hire faculty who are high quality faculty, but who represent different worldviews that are openly articulated in our universities. And I can imagine, for example, a two-semester first-year seminar where you learn the 12 major worldviews, and I'll talk a lot more about them tomorrow in my lecture. But I think that brings back the ideal, which is, a wonderful ideal of the marketplace of ideas. You may not like the language of marketplace, but I think it captures the idea that people can really wrestle with ideas, their rationality can be truly engaged. And as Joshua Mitchell says, this kind of university would promote the politics of competence. That is, a citizenry who knows how to be responsible citizens in our society. He believes that the woke system is creating a politics of innocence and oppression. I think that's his language. And he sees that leading to bloodshed. Now, number three, there are other organizations that to some degree or another are allies in this effort, and I've listed them there. I'm a big fan of National Association of Scholars. I love Braver Angels. One of the founders of Braver Angels, by the way, which is an effort to bring together people from the opposite ends of the political spectrum to appreciate each other. One of the founders, late in life, has just become a follower of Christ. It's really an amazing story. It's really amazing. And then last of all, University of Austin, a few of you have heard about that. This is their logo on the right there. They are trying to be this kind of university. They have a $250 million grant to get them started. We'll see if they take off. I asked Marvin Olasky if he's going to teach journalism there, and don't know, maybe.
Is this Austin, Texas?
Yes, it's in Austin, Texas, but it's meant to be a genuinely pluralistic public university. That's the so if they succeed, then the stock in my vision for this, and I've written papers about this, will go up. But Barry Weiss is working with FAIR, and I mentioned FAIR. So, but Barry's, yes, you're right. Barry is involved with the University of Austin. You are right. Quite a wide variety of people, many of them on the left, but they want legitimate fairness. Now, last of all, I'll just very quickly mention this is a model of human flourishing. I believe that if we want to be transforming the world of public education, and I say this with my friend Dave Glessny here with Third Educational Revolution and Virtues Campus, I believe that this model here, which is all based on Genesis 1, is really a model that can essentially encompass what you should aim for in any kind of education, an education that enhances your abilities and characteristics, as well as helps clarify the goal that you should be working for and your actual functional purposes in the world.